6. This morning, a little breeze from the southwest at 13. 43 degrees Racine, 40 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The name of the book at hand is An Elegant Defense, and I think most people would not ever guess what the subtitle is or what this book is actually about from those intriguing first 3 words. An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in 4 Lives. This is an extraordinary book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author by the name of Matt Richtel. And in this book, Matt Richtel, a reporter for the New York Times, explores the hidden and, to some extent, still mysterious intricacies of our body's immune system and some of the key players and also some of the chief ways in which the immune system of the human body can go awry and actually cause us terrible problems. And as a matter of fact, those numbers are rapidly on the rise. More and more people are suffering from various disorders related to the misbehavior, if you will, of our body's immune system. And Matt Richtel has explored all of this in illuminating fashion and writes about these complicated matters in a way that even those of us not all that scientifically gifted can actually understand. So it is a very impressive achievement indeed. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner for national reporting for a series of articles about distracted driving that sprang from one of his first books, A Deadly Wandering. And his work has appeared in many, many different places. This book is published by William Morrow, again titled An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in 4 Lives. Matt Richtel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you for that really gratifying opening as well.
I think it is no small matter, no small feat, let's say, to write about complicated scientific information in a way that is going to make sense to someone who is not a scientist or well-versed in the sciences. Can you take us inside that challenge and what kinds of things you thought about as you crafted this book?
Yeah, well, I'll actually start at the end. I got this in the acknowledgments. I note this very well-known immunologist among many, many I had the privilege of interviewing. And I said to him at one point, Why are you, Dr. McCune, why are you spending so much time, your valuable time, explaining all this complicated science to me? And he said, Matt, I'm trying to create the most glib immunologist who ever lived. And I said, why is that? And he said, because someone has to explain to people what it is we do. And, you know, it turns out that this science, the science of the immune system, has exploded. So much so, Greg, that there is an argument to be made that it is the center of all medicine and clinical work right now. And it has long been a backwater. So to answer your question more directly, when I began to understand that the centrality of this to health, longevity, happiness, I basically put on my pith helmet and I started digging and digging and digging and committed myself to trying to understand this system in the first place, and then to try to meet the commitment I made to all those people I interviewed, which was to be as accessible as humanly possible. And it was a 3-year project.
I think one of the interesting choices you made was something that gives the book a certain frame that it otherwise would not have, and that is told in the last 5 words of your second subtitle, A Tale in 4 Lives, that this is a book not only about this wide and complex sort of scientific discipline, but it is also wrapped around the personal stories of 4 different people for whom the immune system is a very crucial player for good or for ill. Explain the place of these 4 lives within this wider story.
Yeah. So in brief, I will tell you about the one that launched this whole project and then answer the question more broadly. I had a friend named Jason from high school who was Mr. Everything at the time. This is eons ago. All-state baseball, all-state basketball, great-looking guy, got all the girls. About a few years ago when we were in our 40s, he got lymphoma, cancer, and it's the kind that's supposed to be curable, but it was not. And after 3 to 4 years of radiation and chemotherapy, he had 15 pounds of tumor in his back. And his oncologist in Denver, we grew up in Colorado, said to him, Jason, I love you, man, but it's time to go home and die. And he went into hospice. And at the last second, even in hospice, he took this off-label, not yet for the market, immunotherapy drug. And a couple weeks after he took it, and again, remember, he's got 9 toes in the grave here, his girlfriend woke him up and said, Jason, you're not going to believe this. Your tumors have disappeared. Wow, full stop, man rises from grave. And I'm his buddy and a New York Times science reporter, and I pick up my pen and I say, okay, not just what is immunotherapy, what is the immune system? So now to answer your question, he became one character, and he's a character whose immune system, in effect, was insufficient to fight the disease it faced. But I realized that the spectrum of the immune system and its impact on us is so broad that to make this accessible, I needed characters who represented other aspects of it. So here's Jason with an insufficient immune system, if you will. Then I picked 2 women who have autoimmune disorders, and their immune systems are too powerful. Their immune systems attack themselves. So if you think of this as Goldilocks, the Goldilocks story, Jason had too much, too little, these women had too much. And then I found this remarkable character, Greg. His name is Bob Hoff. He has, in effect, a perfect immune system, so good that the NIH studies his immune system to figure out how it works so well. And these gave us an emotional insight and a personal intimate touchstone for all the scientific theory in the book.
It's a great choice, and I think it helps us understand what is going on here so very, very well. Before we talk about the immune system, I want to spend a moment talking about this really unsettling phenomenon of the rapid rise in immune disorders that are just the scourge of so many people's lives. I can think of, I'm a voice teacher also outside of the radio station, and I can think of 2 of my finest former voice students who are both battling the effects of Crohn's disease right now. And of course, there are a number of other disorders as well that are related to an immune system sort of gone amok or rapidly growing and attacking the body instead of protecting it. What are the most important theories at the moment as to why we are seeing so much more of this than we once did?
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Are those men or women?
Men.
They're men. Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I remember you saying that we do see more women than men in general suffering from these autoimmunity disorders.
Largely disproportionate women. And I realize you preface this with by suggesting that we define the immune system after, but it might help if I defined the immune system before, because it will help explain why these very traumatic and very vexing and frustrating illnesses are on the rise. Would you indulge me with a little bit of scientific background here?
I think that actually makes a great deal of sense.
Okay. Sorry, forgive me for, I always take my cues from you, but I realize as you were asking the question, I thought, I'm going to have trouble getting there. So let me start with this most basic idea, which is that I brought a lot of misconceptions into this book. In fact, I would say more than anything I've written, and I'm an old saw journalist at this point, or an old horse, I was just one misconception after the next. And maybe the most basic one had to do with what the immune system is and does. So I brought into this book the idea that the immune system is this zealous police fighter that would just get everything alien out of our system and do it with ruthless efficiency. That was my idea. And there is some part of that that's true. To illustrate the immune system, I'm going to make a movie reference here. Do you remember The Matrix?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so remember at some point these characters realize that there's ones and zeros all around them, that they live in a world populated by computer code, but it comes across as all these ones and zeros around them. Well, analogously, one of the first and most important principles to think about with regard to the immune system is the world that it exists in. And if you look around you, if you look on your desk, your computer monitor, your microphone, if I look at the cup of coffee that I'm holding on my shirt, we are covered in microbes. We are covered in bacteria, in parasite, in virus. Here's the thing, Greg. Most of these would do us no harm. So we are living in an alien world, or rather we share the world with alien organisms. And for us to survive, and this is just absolutely crucial, we must mostly get along with the creatures that surround us, are on us, and are inside our gut to the point where half the cells in our body are not human. Does that conception make sense to start?
That's helpful, I think, yes.
Okay, perfect. So now, here's your defense network inside you. It's more than your defense network. Arguably, it is your everything network. It is the thing that keeps you alive and participating in the world. And its chief job is not to attack everything that is alien. If it did that, we'd be scorched earth. Its chief job is to try to get along as well as possible, and then only attack when necessary, and when attacking, do so with precise violence that does as little collateral damage as possible. I tend to think of the immune system not as a war machine, but more like a peace machine, and more precisely, like the love child of a bouncer and a ballet dancer. It can be extremely powerful, but it would like to do so on tippy toes.
Hmm. So that's the delicate balancing act that is part of a properly functioning immune system.
Among other reasons, that is the name of the title, An Elegant Defense. It is a fiercely, fiercely elegant defender of our body.
Right.
It almost is an oxymoron.
And of course, even beyond what you have just described, one of the wonders of the immune system is that it also has to be able to respond to things that it has never seen or encountered before. You, in the opening of the chapter called The Infinity Machine, you paint a scenario of somebody going off to some other exotic location and yes. the body is suddenly encountering perhaps bacteria that it never has before. And how does the immune system manage to respond, in a sense, to brand new and completely unfamiliar enemies? You call this the infinity problem. But under the best of circumstances, the body's immunity system solves this problem.
I mean, I get shivers when you say that, because this is one of those chapters and subjects where the marvel of this thing here, I'm going to make the sound of my head exploding. That's what it sounded like when I learned how the body prepares to face an enemy never seen and maybe that has never appeared before. And that has to do with the way the genetics of our immune system scramble up to create a virtually infinite number of possible scenarios. But I just want to point out that that is a marvelous piece of this. Let me go back now to how this connects to autoimmune disorders. So you've got this very finely tuned system, or rather, you've got a system that is constantly trying to strike the most delicate balance. And what happens is that you can imagine, given the complexity of the world, it is relatively easy. I mean, not a given, but relatively easy for it to lose balance. Imagine, for instance, you get a virus and your body responds to it, and the immune system reacts a little too violently, and there's residual effect, and it begins to continue to fight even after the virus is gone. I mean, I'm sure you've had those experiences where you get sick, and you feel like you're over it, and yet you have lots of fatigue, low-grade fever. This could be existing residual inflammation as the body seeks to get back into balance or homeostasis again. But let's take the more extreme case in the rise of autoimmune disorders. A couple of things to say about it. What is an autoimmune disorder? An autoimmune disorder is where this finely tuned system becomes imbalanced such that it attacks either the body or it attacks something inside. In the case of allergy, I'm going to lump these together, it attacks something that's actually not that threatening as if it was threatening. So a peanut allergy, you might have the body attacking in a way far disproportionate to the actual threat, and you could die from that. In an autoimmune disorder like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or Crohn's or go down the list, the body is reacting to itself as if it were an alien organism. I refer to these folks in the book historically as the invisible sufferers. The thing inside them was invisible because it was only them, and society treated them as if they were invisible. How many times have you heard the phrase, maybe it's in your head, you're acting a little hysterical, why don't you get a little rest? It's quite cruel, because just because the thing is invisible doesn't make it any less real. So I'll work my way around to why these are on the rise, but does that yes. part make sense so far?
Absolutely.
So one of the reasons these are on the rise, well, first of all, we don't fully understand why they're on the rise, but there are some reasons that may be actually less related to our environment and more related to a couple simple, just simple factors, like we are living longer. The longer we live, the more opportunity there is for this system to get out of balance. We are, in many respects, outliving what the immune system evolved to defend us for. And so if you think about what the immunologist will say is, we were meant to get an effect to reproductive age and somewhat beyond. And you can make a pretty good case, and the book makes this case, and I won't belabor it here, but that the immune system actually is part of killing us off individually to save the species. But as we live longer, there's more of a chance for the body to get out of whack. We are also beginning to see these things for what they are, meaning there may have been much more autoimmune disorder than we realized, and we called it, you're tired, or we called it. But make no mistake, this is well, well beyond that. But then there's other factors that may be contributing. For instance, the super hygienic environment we live in, and this pertains more to allergy than to autoimmune disorder, but as you can see, they are cousins in that they represent an overreaction of the immune system. But we live, certainly in the developed world, in an increasingly and arguably overly hygienic world. What does that mean? Well, remember I had that, so again, I don't want to be long-winded. Are you with me so
nope,
far?
Yes,
or
sure.
Is everyone falling asleep?
Go for it.
Okay, so remember I was talking about all those ones and zeros around us, the microbes, not pathogens. Pathogens are more deadly ones. Microbes are just all the things around us, broadly speaking. We need those. Our immune system needs those inputs from those microbes in order to learn how to calibrate when to bounce and when to ballet, when to tiptoe lightly and when to attack. It learns. It goes to boot camp on all those microbes that are around us. Well, as we have sanitized our environment, now, I'm not talking about washing your hands before you eat or after you go to the bathroom or, you know, really basic stuff that is essential and I don't want to discourage anyone from doing. But when we start pouring the goop on our kids, on ourselves, every time we touch a banister or get on a bus or walk outside, and believe me, I've got 8 and 10-year-olds. I know what it means to pour the goop on them. What we've done is we have starved our immune systems of the inputs necessary to be very good at calibrating the environment. So in our household, despite the fact, maybe I shouldn't say despite the fact, maybe because of the fact, my wife's a doctor, I've learned all this, we have cut way back on the goop. And we've basically said, you know, sometimes we may get a head cold. Sometimes we may get a mild virus. Sometimes we may get an infection. But that is part of the healing process overall. It is part of the learning process for our immune system over the long run. And there's a good case to be made that allergies are on the rise because we are starving the body of its calibration tools.
In other words, we are living, in a sense, too cleanly, and that a little bit of dirt, a little bit of bacteria, actually quite a lot of bacteria, is actually necessary in order for this system to properly function. One of the ways in which my eyes lit up when I first read about your book was when you said something about how it's okay for children to eat dirt. I ate dirt when I was a child, and fortunately, my family's forward-thinking doctor thought that was perfectly fine, and so I was allowed to continue to do that. I'm not sure for just how long, but you tell us that that's actually not the worst thing that somebody can do to their body.
Look, think about it in an evolutionary sense. Our industrial processes of cleansing are less than 100 years old. But our evolution, in our body evolved under circumstances far different. Now, again, I don't want to be cavalier about the processes. I quote Exodus in the book. Ritual hand washing was mentioned in the Bible. Many religions were cautious about eating certain animals because they confer a lot of bacteria. So I'm not saying it was great to be surrounded by filth, if you will, but we have overcorrected. Here's my mantra: hygiene, not hysteria. I think that's what is a way to think about how to treat your immune system properly.
Why is stress something that you talk about in your book as an important factor in the functioning or lack of function of the immunity system? Why should stress matter?
Yeah, so there's a few concrete suggestions at the end of this book, but they're made with some pretty deep science, and stress is probably the most evocative one, and I'm glad you brought it up. So I want to explain the relationship between stress and the immune system by taking us all back to our forebears. If you imagine the version of you 50,000 years ago. So just picture yourself just a lot hairier, and you're running across the savanna from a lion. And in that moment, your body is shifting a lot of resources, and they're being shifted to survive the lion attack, and they're not so worried about any kind of chronic thing. In other words, the lion's much scarier than the head cold at that point. And so your immune system gets we shift our resources, internal resources, away from the immune system. In fact, it's not only a broad shift to put the resources towards surviving the acute threat. It's also because, as you know, when you're dealing with a cold, you feel tired. When you're dealing with a virus, you may have a fever. You will be alleviated of those symptoms so that you can survive the acute threat. This is because of a whole bunch of outpouring of chemicals like norepinephrine and epinephrine and cortisol. They're like superhero chemicals. But here's the problem. In today's world, so in that time, you are inviting infection to take hold, but only because you need to survive the more acute threat. Well, in today's world, we often feel like stress, the fight or flight experience that many of us have, we often interpret it internally as if there were a lion, but there is no lion. Hmm. So the more we allow ourselves to get stressed, the more we create an acute threat that isn't so dangerous and meanwhile undermine our immune system. I will give you a very concrete example from 2 weeks ago. This book launched. It started on NPR. It soared to 16 on Amazon. Everything was exciting. I didn't sleep well for two nights. I got the flu. No one else in my family got the flu. It was such an object lesson. And incidentally, I should tell you, I was doing all the things I taught myself to do, and I couldn't make it work fully. But look, there was no lion. Far from it. This was all blessings, right? And I wound up giving myself the flu and had to withdraw very seriously for a few days in order to allow my immune system to get back into balance, because I had starved it. So there's more science in the book about stress and sleep, but it follows a lot along the same lines. There is no lion.
Mm. Last question. You are writing this book and have released it to the public at a point in time when our interest in this is really exploding, and it seems like new developments are occurring all of the time. Do you have some sense of where this is going, and in particular, the highest priorities of those who are working on a greater understanding of how our immune system works?
Yeah, I'm gonna give you three areas that I think are extraordinary, and that were we around, well, if we make it another 50 years or another 100, it's going to be, you know, on the order of flying cars. One is the microbiome, and we're just understanding that this bacteria that lives inside of us play an incredible role in our health. And the reason they do that is because they want us to survive. We are their home. But it's very hard to tease apart what the microbiome does, because it's lots of molecules all mashed up together inside of us, and the science is challenging. Number two is dementia and the brain. We're going to discover, and we are discovering, that the connection between inflammation, meaning the response of an immune system, and what happens to our neurodegenerative processes is going to explode. And finally, I think our cancer and autoimmune treatments, autoimmune disorder treatments, are going to get more refined. Right now, for as many strides as we've made, there's a lot of collateral damage that comes from these immunotherapies you've heard about, and that I discussed in the case of Jason. So I would say stay tuned on all of that stuff.
Hmm. Your book explores vaccines, antibiotics, T cells, B cells, and much, much more. It is endlessly fascinating and so very well written. An Elegant Defense, The Extraordinary New Science of the Immune System, A Tale in Four Lives, published by William Morrow, the author, Matt Richtel. Matt Richtel, thank you so much. I was honored to speak with you, and I loved your book.
Have a great day, Greg.
And Matt Richtel asked me to mention, for the sake of our Milwaukee listeners, that the book is available at Boswell Books at 2559 North Downer Avenue in Milwaukee. The book is also available at Barnes & Noble and wherever books are sold. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And now an interview from The Morning Show archives. My guest for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show is Dr. Marie Pazinski, a Harvard neurologist and the author of a book called Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, Look Radiant from the Inside Out by Empowering Your Mind. Dr. Pazinski knows a lot about the human brain, about how it functions, about the way in which it impacts our well-being on so many different levels. And she makes some connections in this book that may come as something of a surprise, and the way in which the health of one's brain and the vitality of one's mental life can have a whole lot to do with the way you feel and the way you carry yourself and the way in which the world sees you. We're also going to spend a few minutes talking about all of the different facets of a neurologist's work, and in particular, the concern which many people have around one of the most significant of brain injuries, and that would be the stroke, and how strokes can be perhaps avoided or prevented, or the best way to respond when someone is unfortunate enough to be suffering a stroke. So all of that is ahead of us, and I want to repeat the name of the book again, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You. Dr. Marie Pazinski, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
I wonder if we could begin by having you say a word about how you became a neurologist. I guess not so much how, but maybe why. If there was something that in particular about this particular field that was so attractive to you. I suspect that you were weighing a lot of different possibilities. How is this the one that you ultimately chose?
Well, I was fortunate in medical school to have a wonderful mentor who was an artist before he went into medicine. And actually, I studied art before I went into medicine. In fact, my first experience going into thinking about medicine was when my oldest brother asked me to come see his cadaver in medical school. And I'll never forget, he took me over to the anatomy lab that night, and he was showing me the dissection that they had done on the upper extremity. And for me, it was like Leonardo da Vinci's neuroanatomy drawings coming alive. And, you know, I saw the beauty of the human body. And as an artist, to see what was under the skin and how the body was put together, I was so struck by that. And that's how I first became interested in medicine. And then when I did my neurology rotation during medical school, my attending neurologist, the one who kind of oversaw my work, happened to be an artist as well. And so it was kind of that connection that I think drew me in. He was able to show me how beautiful the brain is and how it is endlessly fascinating.
What does a neurologist concern themselves with apart from the human brain? I mean, I suspect that although that certainly should be more than enough to occupy one academic and professional attention, I suspect, in fact, your area of focus when it comes to safeguarding people's well-being has to do with even more than the actual brain itself.
Right. It's overall health. The brain truly is the like CEO of our body. It controls everything about us. And our body is our support staff, more or less, because we need a healthy body to keep our brain running at its best. So the two really work together. And it's important to me as a neurologist to do everything that I can to help people keep their brain and their bodies healthy. And so I care for patients with a wide range of neurologic problems, which includes migraine, epilepsy, dementia, stroke, certainly, movement disorders. It's a very broad field.
And I should think a very exciting field in the sense that so many of the technological breakthroughs have directly impacted this particular area of medical science in such exciting ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the brain in many ways is the last frontier of the human body. You know, we still have so much to learn, but there have been incredible breakthroughs over recent years, and this is what's so exciting. I think the most important, most significant breakthrough is our understanding that our brain is constantly changing. You know, we used to think it was static and that we were born with all the brain cells we would ever have, but what we now understand is that our brain is constantly changing, and it has the ability to make new brain cells and new connections throughout our lives. And the other thing we realize is that every experience changes our brain. So even as you and I are talking and people are listening, our brains are changing. And what we now understand is that the more stimulating these experiences are, the more enriching, the more profound the changes in the brain can be.
At what point did you come across or conceive of this connection between the health of the brain and one's beauty? It's such an intriguing idea. At what point did this first occur to you, that this was a connection that people need to make?
Well, actually from personal experience. I'll never forget one morning I was really stressed out. It was a very busy time in my life. I'm a mother of two, and my youngest was actually quite young. I was doing my residency. I was sleep deprived. I was not taking care of myself. I was neglecting my brain. And I'll never forget looking in the mirror one morning and just feeling mentally foggy, just not feeling clear at all. And I had this look in my face, just kind of this vacant, dull look that kind of matched the way I felt mentally. You know, and it struck me then that no amount of, you know, makeup or, you know, beautiful hairstyle was going to change the way I look. That the problem was I wasn't having a bad brain day, or I wasn't having a bad hair day. What I was having was a bad brain day. And that's how I kind of came up with this idea. And, you know, and you realize that your brain determines everything about you. It truly is your essence. And it is the source of our inner beauty. Every thought, emotion, and mood comes from our brain. And it interprets every sensation that we have in every movement that we make. And many people don't realize it, but it also determines the way you present yourself to the world. You can never look your best unless your brain is functioning at its best.
Towards that end, you have quite a number of suggestions. I mean, they're kind of wrapped up in, I think, a big list of seven steps that one can take either successively or concurrently, but steps one can take to really enhance the health of one's brain. And it's kind of a combination of choices to embrace, I mean, things to do, and certain things to avoid as well, which you think significantly compromise the health of the brain. Let's actually start with the latter. What are some things that people should avoid when it comes to wanting to enhance the health of their brain?
Well, one of the most important things we can do is stay physically active. So physical inactivity can really negatively affect your brain. There's been exciting research showing that when we're physically active, we get our heart rate up, we actually have increased the blood flow to our brain. And this increased blood flow promotes the birth of new neurons and the formation of new connections. And there are exciting studies showing that people who do regular exercise, they actually did a study where they looked at the volume of people's brains by MRI, we have the ability to do that now, before beginning an exercise regimen and then afterward. And they had a control group that didn't exercise aerobically. Instead, they did a stretch and tone class. And those that exercised aerobically and got their heart rate up showed an increased volume in their brain. They actually increased the thickness of their cortex. And that's the part of the brain that we reason with and make memories with. And so this is so exciting and shows how important exercise is and how you can really make your brain healthier, stronger, and more vibrant by exercise.
I know that you feel strongly about certain dietary choices that can make a real difference. Can you highlight two or three of those that you believe would make a very significant difference for the better?
Mm-hmm. So in Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, I recommend what's called the SMART diet. And one of the key things about the diet is choosing the type of fats that you eat and making smart choices around the type of fats. Our brain is actually two-thirds fat, and the main fat in our brain is omega-3s, and our body cannot make omega-3s, so the only omega-3s we can get are through our diet. So it's really important to eat a diet rich in omega-3s and to avoid saturated fats, unhealthy fats, because those actually clog up the arteries that supply the brain. Our brain only weighs 3 pounds, but it actually uses 20% of the blood flow that our heart puts out. And so maintaining good blood flow to the brain is extremely important. And so that's why it's being aware of the type of fats that you're eating and avoiding those that clog up our arteries and reduce blood flow to the brain is extremely important.
I know that you have suggestions, some of which are perfectly reasonable and are more like reminders for us of things that we probably are already quite aware of are good stimulating things for us to do. But you certainly have suggestions in your book, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, which probably fall well outside the realm of the obvious in terms of different kinds of activities that can be beneficial. Give a couple of examples to our listeners.
Well, one of the things I recommend is people try new things and open their brain to new ideas. As I was saying, every experience we have changes our brain. And as we get older, we so often limit ourselves to new experiences, to being open to new experiences. We get in a rut. And what happens is when we're doing the same kind of things, we're stuck in our routine, we're actually using the same mental pathways. But when we learn something new, we're actually forging new mental pathways. So I really encourage people to really think about that. What are they doing for their brain that's new and exciting is going to challenge their brain? One of the things I also talk about is thinking about what I call your life learning curve. And that means the number of new things or new activities you take up, new things you're exposed to during your everyday life. And if you were to map that out, I think most of us would have so many new experiences and new ideas when we were young and in school. You know, we're constantly meeting new people, going new places, being exposed to new ideas, and all of that is so wonderful for our brain. But as we get older, we tend to get into a routine way of living, a routine way of thinking. We solve the same kind of problems, and in that way, we're not using our brain to its full potential. So I recommend that people, you know, try to take up a new activity, you know, whatever strikes your fancy. It's best if it's something that you're passionate about. And the idea is that when you learn a new activity, you really are making new pathways in your brain. That's exciting. Your brain actually spurts out dopamine when it's exposed to something new, and that increases your attention and it makes it pleasurable too.
This is maybe an important moment for us to say that someone might see the title Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, and think that this book has nothing to offer to men. And that would be a mistake.
You're right. The principles are the same. They would apply to men and women. There are 7 steps in the book that they kind of build on each other and support each other, and in the process, you'll end up with a healthier, more vibrant brain.
We are speaking with Dr. Marie Pazinski. We've been talking about her book, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, published by Hyperion. For our last couple of minutes, I wonder if we could talk just a bit about stroke. For a couple of different reasons, stroke information, stroke prevention has been in the news quite a lot, maybe most dramatically because of that on-air experience of a young female reporter who was suddenly speaking gibberish, unable to form proper coherent words. Although she ended up not being the victim of a stroke, but rather a severe migraine headache, evidently, the fact that this event occurred in the public eye has certainly sparked kind of a renewed interest and concern about strokes and other kinds of brain injuries. First of all, what is most important for the common ordinary citizen to know about strokes in terms of their own well-being? And are there things that one can do to lessen the likelihood of that a stroke is going to be a part of their own future?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I'd like to emphasize is knowing the symptoms of stroke. You can save a life, or help yourself. What most people don't realize is that even if the symptoms of stroke go away, that means the brain is in trouble. So it's not uncommon before a stroke for people to have what's called a TIA or a stroke warning. So these are neurologic symptoms like weakness or difficulty speaking that last maybe 5 minutes and then go away. And too often people feel, well, if the symptoms go away, I'm fine, that they don't do anything about it. But that actually is an emergency. We should call 911 if any of these symptoms develop again, even if they go away. So the five symptoms of stroke can be remembered as walk, talk, reach, see, and feel. So if someone suddenly has trouble walking, their balance is off, or they're dragging a leg, if there's a change in their talking, their speech becomes slurred, or they are not making sense. Reach refers to having difficulty raising one arm, being weak on one side. If there's a sudden change in vision, if someone loses part or all of their vision, or a sudden severe headache, all of those are signs, potential signs of a stroke. And again, when these symptoms develop, it's so important to get medical attention. And again, even if they go away, because it means that the brain is in trouble. And certainly if they don't go away and they persist, medical evaluation is needed. We now have, some therapies that we can give to people who have stroke, but many times people do not get to the hospital in time. One of the medicines we give is called TPA. It's a clot-busting medication, but we can only give it within 3 hours of the onset of symptoms. So again, it's so important to get to the emergency room as soon as possible.
Dr. Marie Pazinski is the author of Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You. And you have a website, and now the address is escaping me. Can you tell it to our listeners, please?
Yes, it's www.mariepazinski.com.
Very good. Marie Pazinski is a Harvard neurologist. I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be talking about the Racine Heritage Museum, and we'll also be talking with Dr. James Kinchin from the University of Wisconsin Parkside Music Department. He is the director of choral activities there, presiding over some exciting performances coming up this weekend: Schubert's Mass in G with the Tremper Chorale, and the following weekend, the Forêt Requiem with the Union Grove High School Choir. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what